From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. May the 4th be with you. Today is a day when Star Wars fans around the world celebrate their love of this growing constellation of stories from a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. My first guest today has spent a lot of time not just enjoying Star Wars as an escapist fantasy, but thinking, writing, and talking about the deeper meanings of these stories. Stephen Kent is the author of How the Force Can Fix the World, Lessons on Life, Liberty, and Happiness from a Galaxy Far, Far Away. In it, he acknowledges America is on a dark path, a time of fear and division. And as Jedi Master Yoda warned the young boy who would one day become Darth Vader,
"Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering."
And suffering, many of us are. But in Star Wars, Kent writes, there's a message of hope that could be a path forward. He says, "The characters and core themes of Star Wars offer lessons on living that, if taken as more than just fantasy, offer a real blueprint for having a happier life and healthier politics. These intergalactic tales, whether we encounter them on the big screen, TV, or on bookshelves, consistently revolve around the importance of empathy, humility, courage, hope, redemption, balance, and choice." Kent previously hosted the Beltway Banthas podcast on Star Wars and politics and the YouTube show Right Now with Stephen Kent, which was part of Al Jazeera's short-lived Rightly network. Today he writes a newsletter on Substack called This Is the Way. Stephen Kent, welcome to the 21st show. May the 4th be with you.
Brian, may the 4th be with you as well. Thank you for having me.
And listeners, big flashing spoiler warning. I'm declaring fair game everything that happens in every Star Wars story, including the films and TV series. So if you've been holding out on Andor or The Mandalorian or A New Hope and you don't want to know how things go, turn off the radio, hit pause. Once you're caught up, I hope you'll find the podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen. For now, you can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, Stephen, let's talk origin stories. How did you first get into Star Wars?
You know, my earliest Star Wars memories as a child of 1989 was actually just playing with the action figures, the merchandising on the hill outside of my home in North Carolina. My brother and I had all of the Return of the Jedi and Empire Strikes Back toys. And I just have these very real, like just these memories that stuck of playing with my Luke Skywalker Return of the Jedi toy, playing King of the Hill with my brother. And then we had the VHS box tapes that we got in 1997. Beyond that, my first real Star Wars memories involving movies were actually the prequels and seeing them in theaters in the early 2000s.
That's great. Yeah, my first movie experience was Return of the Jedi in 1983. I was a little too young for the other ones, but I did have, like you said, a VHS cassette. Mine was bootlegged off HBO, though, sign of the times. So what you write in the book about sort of awakening to the idea of some of the politics in the movies as you're watching them in the theaters. When did you first come to see these stories as political and not just fantasy?
Well, I was about 15 years old, give or take, when Revenge of the Sith Episode 3 was beginning to get promoted and head towards theaters. This is, of course, 2005. We are several years into the War on Terror and the post 9/11 world at that point. At that time in my life, I, you know, was pretty conservative for a young person. I was like the weirdo, like goth Republican in my high school. So I drew a lot of odd attention, but I was very interested in politics from a very early age. And we knew very early on in Star Wars that the prequel trilogy was headed towards the Republic becoming an empire. I remember hanging out with my friends and we had just watched the trailer for Episode 3. And we were hearing Emperor Palpatine talk about how this new empire was going to bring, you know, peace, freedom, security. And we were all watching what was going on in the news with George W. Bush and the war on terror, our invasion of Iraq, and talking to one another, is this going to end the same way? Is this guy going to step down from power, or is the war on terror a war on all things that are threats that has to, you know, go on forever? So I would say I kind of got that sense right around that time, and I never really let go.
All right. Well, we have a clip from one of those moments that came in that third movie, or at least episode three, I guess. We'll refer to the films in their numerical order, not necessarily the order they were released. But this is when the elected Chancellor Palpatine, having survived an attempted coup by the Jedi, has declared the end of the Republic in the beginning of the First Galactic Empire. He does this to a room full of cheering senators, just a few of whom register even quiet disapproval.
So this is how liberty dies. With thunderous applause.
It is now my honor to sign into law the USA Patriot Act of 2001.
All right, Stephen, I juxtaposed some clips there, taking a little political little commentary. Am I overreading what Star Wars was saying?
No, you're not reading overreading at all with what George Lucas was hoping to convey during the prequels. There's definitely been sort of a narrative around the political overtones of those movies that I think has maybe been overstretched. And I say that because folks will usually read into Obi-Wan Kenobi and Anakin's dialogue in episode three that if you're either with us or you're either with me or you're my enemy, as being a direct take on George on Bush's comment that you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. I believe he said that in one of his State of the Union addresses. So you have the war on terror break out right after 9/11, but George Lucas wrote these movies for the most part in the 1990s, and we should look at them as sort of miraculous coincidences that the 9/11 attacks occur, then we launch ourselves into war under pretty phony pretenses. And then it also happens to be that the Clone Wars story that George Lucas has written for episodes 2 and 3 also happened to be a war based on phony pretenses launched by the Chancellor Palpatine himself in order to secure more power. I think that these are just sort of interesting flukes of history, but it speaks to Star Wars universality. This has happened in civilization after civilization, in culture after culture. So, you know, we're not particularly unique. And I think that that's why when we look at Star Wars and the prequels in particular, we see ourselves.
And it's fundamentally those stories are about a war of choice, right? Not necessarily a war of necessity if somebody is engineering it.
That's right. So many of the conflicts in Star Wars are conflicts of choice. You have a fear of something bad could happen, right? You're Luke Skywalker. You have a vision of Han and Leia suffering in Cloud City in episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back. And you have a choice about whether or not you are going to continue your Jedi training or you're going to rush into battle and ultimately do nothing to help them and lose your hand in the process. You have Anakin Skywalker in episode 3, a vision of his wife dying, which leads him down the path to making a deal with the devil, killing innocent people and overthrowing the Republic, only to then be the cause of his wife's death in the end in a very sort of Greek tragedy kind of way. And as such, many of our conflicts in society, sometimes with people, our friends, our family, and also between nation states, they are wars of choice, and every war that the United States has engaged in, at least in my lifetime, I will say, are all wars of choice that we decided to make. And I include the war in terror and even the response to 9/11 in that as well.
Yeah, definitely. This gets us into the subject of the Clone Wars themselves. We talked about this war of choice, and I think it's sort of the casual fan can watch these movies and think Jedis are the good guys, right? We've always known they're the light side of the Force, the dark side. They're fighting the separatists. But it's really a little more complicated when you drill down into the politics of what's really happening there. Have we been too facile in assuming the Jedi are the good guy throughout this story?
You know, I don't think so, actually, but maybe that's because I spend so much time around Star Wars fans who love to have these kinds of lofty debates and contrarian takes about the Jedi and the Republic. You know, maybe Jar Jar Binks was a Sith Lord. It was all the Jedi's fault that the Republic fell. You know, these are kind of inner fandom debates. But then you skip ahead to Episode 8, The Last Jedi, one of the more recent Star Wars films, and Luke Skywalker is espousing the view that many fans gave during the prequel era, that the Jedi were the problem all along and that the Jedi Order facilitated their own destruction. And they very much did. You know, when you think about the Jedi as sort of a religious organization, they're devoted to defending the light side of the Force. They felt a darkness growing in the galaxy. They felt that the Sith had returned, that the dark side was out there once again. And what do? They not only seek to destroy it in the name of balance, which is actually really shocking when you think about how the Jedi said that they were going to restore balance to the Force, but that would come by having no dark side and no Sith. And then they enlist along with the Republic to wage a war on the thing that they are afraid of, rather than maybe separating themselves from the power of government. They become intertwined with it. And it's actually a wonderful lesson for all of us about how far we want to go and what kind of authority and government power do we want to use for the causes that we care about. Because one day that power and authority might get used against us.
Absolutely. And I want to come back to how far we go in resisting power and authority that we have problems with, because that's one of the themes of the more recent Andor television series. But, you know, I wonder if there, I'm just going to imagine in straw man here, some listeners who might be thinking, oh my gosh, these people are going so deep on the politics of this silly kids movie. But, you know, this stuff was really there from the beginning. And I want to play another clip. This is from the first movie, Star Wars, as it was known to me, or A New Hope, as it's been rebranded in more recent years, or I guess it was soon after. But let's listen to this clip. This is a group of Imperial officers in a conference room on the Death Star arguing about the growing rebellion.
The rebellion will continue to gain a support in the Imperial Senate.
The Imperial Senate will no longer be of any concern to us. I have just received word that the Emperor has dissolved the Council permanently. The last remnants of the Old Republic have been swept away.
That's impossible. How will the Emperor maintain control without the bureaucracy?
The regional governors now have direct control over their territories. Fear will keep the local systems in line. Fear of this battle station.
Stephen, how will the Emperor maintain control of the bureaucracy, or without the bureaucracy, I should say?
Well, he will do it through fear and with a super weapon in order to keep everybody in line. It's a really interesting scene. And when you think about the whole point of the Death Star project, you know, we should try to understand that what the Death Star project is a fledgling government's fear that they cannot actually keep the galaxy in order. Everyone is used to being part of the Republic. Everybody did not agree necessarily to becoming part of the Empire. And so what they're going to do is force everyone to comply, force everyone to the table. But does force always work? Does it always engender submission in our opponents? Or do people lash out when they feel threatened? One of the things that we learned from Rogue One, which I thought was incredibly interesting, was that the rebellion was fractious, broken, and ineffective leading up to the original films. They had different factions, a more radical faction led by this guy Saw Gerrera, and a more establishment, you know, let's return things to the way they were under the Republic faction, led by the rebels that we sort of know and love as our main heroes. And they're not agreeing on anything, and they're not doing anything constructive until the Death Star, which represents an existential threat to them both. And then what happens? They come together and they work together and they blow up the Death Star, delivering a huge blow to the Empire. What's the lesson there? When people use government, weapons, soldiers, war in order to try to control others, they assume that people will just roll over and take it, but they don't always take it, right? We know that sometimes it actually engenders a huge response from our opponents. And I think that's why you see so much of a ratcheting up in our political battles happening in the United States, but really across the Western world, as far right and far left factions are sort of mirroring each other's taste for radicalism. One sort of reflects the other and enhances it. It's really scary. And it's sort of a cycle of battling over the controls of the Death Star that we have to break.
Yeah. And it certainly is engendering a lot of fear. And we're going to talk about how we are responding to that more and how we see Star Wars exploring those divisions and the way people are responding to political crises. We are talking with Stephen Kent, who is the author of the Substack newsletter, This Is the Way, also the book, How the Force Can Fix the World, Lessons on Life, Liberty, and Happiness from a Galaxy Far, Far Away. More to come after a break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
We are talking today with author Stephen Kent. Today is May the 4th, a day when Star Wars fans around the world celebrate their love of this sprawling and growing series of movies and television shows and novels and toys and costumes and now theme park experiences. Stephen Kent is with us. He's the author of How the Force Can Fix the World, Lessons on Life, Liberty, and Happiness from a Galaxy Far, Far Away. He also writes the Substack newsletter, This Is the Way. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number to call in. 800-222-9455. So we were talking before the break about some of the politics of the rebellion in particular, and we really got sort of a grittier look at that with one of the recent television series on Disney Plus, and that is Andor. I think a lot of people were sort of questioning the value of this series. It was going to be, sort of a secondary character in one of the secondary story movies that came out recently, but it's really been well reviewed. I found it fascinating. It's a gritty exploration of the cost of rebellion, the cost of working in an evil empire, and the cost of rebelling against one. And I have another clip here. This is a bit of a long one, but it's probably my favorite moment from the series, a lot of people's favorite. It's when a spymaster character named Luthen Rael, who's played by Stellan Skarsgård, he's talking to one of his double agents, and this guy wants out of the rebellion. He sacrificed too much, but Luthen is not willing to let him go. And so the spy challenges the master about what he is sacrificing.
And what do you sacrifice?
Calm. Kindness, kinship, love. I've given up all chance at inner peace. I made my mind a sunless space. I share my dreams with ghosts. I wake up every day to an equation I wrote 15 years ago from which there's only one conclusion. I'm damned for what I do. My anger, my ego, my unwillingness to yield, my eagerness to fight, that set me on a path from which there's no escape. I yearn to be a savior against injustice without contemplating the cost, and by the time I look down, there's no longer any ground beneath my feet. What is my sacrifice? I'm condemned to use the tools of my enemy to defeat them. I burn my decency for someone else's future. I burn my life to make a sunrise that I know I'll never see. Now, the ego that started this fight will never have a mirror or an audience or the light of gratitude. So what do I sacrifice?
everything!
I don't know how that comes across to anyone who hasn't invested in the prior 9 episodes of the series, but it still gives me chills. Stephen, what does that say to you about the real cost of fighting for one's beliefs?
Oh, yeah, total goosebumps from that entire scene, and a really important message for anybody who gets involved in politics and activism and being a change agent of any kind. You know, I think it's important to note that in Star Wars and in this moment, we are dealing with a time in which democracy is completely eradicated. The Empire is fully established. Freedom is gone. So we are at a point where we're not trying to stop, you know, the bad thing from happening anymore. It's happened. So you have to make a choice about whether or not you're going to continue trying to make change within the system, which some rebels do, or those who are going to start working outside of it and fight for freedom. And I think a lot of people who get involved in politics and activism have an idealism about them, about how it's going to happen, and that people will follow along with them, and that they won't have to sacrifice parts of their lifestyle that maybe they enjoy, their money, their reputation, you know, their status. And this character in Andor is someone who is giving up all of it, really, step by step. I think we just have to ask ourselves what kind of rebels we want to be, and also question whether or not we have to embrace the darkness like Luthen, this rebel, does. He believes that he has to light himself on fire, in essence, to spark the rebellion. But I'm not really convinced that that has to happen. I think he might be lost.
This is it, and this is what frightens me. You know, Star Wars politics are something of a Rorschach test, right? People on the left, people on the right can find in them what they want to see sometimes. And part of me worries that, you know, somebody who thinks it's a good idea to put on a flak jacket and get zip-tie handcuffs and go mm-hmm. into the Senate chamber on January 6th could hear that speech and feel motivated.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we all have a tendency to reflect ourselves on the heroes, the underdogs, the rebels of any cause. I certainly have traveled through a bunch of different political communities. My old podcast, Beltway Banthas, was all about interviewing everyone from the far left to the far right, media figures and politicians alike, about their love of Star Wars. And what you find, whether you're talking to a far left congressperson or a right wing activist, is that they all go, yeah, yeah, we're the rebels, you know, and here's why. And they have a really like good, coherent explanation usually yeah. for why that's the case. And you know what? I think it's all true on for everybody. Like everybody's experience is that they are fighting against some kind of machine that they want to dismantle. How far are you willing to go, though? And are you willing to use the tools of your enemy against them and become what you hate? This is what Star Wars is asking us. In every movie, it's, you know, Luke Skywalker and his fear of becoming like his father, Darth Vader. But you have to walk away from it at some point.
This week, you published an essay on your Substack titled The Mandalorian in an Age of Estrangement. There was at the heart of it was this much discussed Wall Street Journal survey that came out recently. Without going through specific numbers, numbers don't really work on the radio. Can you just take us through some of the findings of that survey?
Yeah, so the findings of this survey that got a whole lot of play basically show that between 1998 and today, the amount of people that the Wall Street Journal and NORC have surveyed, and they've done this repeatedly over several years, who identify as being involved with their communities has dropped from nearly 50% to something like 27%. The amount of people who value having children has dropped by almost half. The amount of people who even view tolerance as a worthwhile virtue has plummeted in recent years across all political factions. I want to underline all political factions are starting to view tolerance as a liability. The only thing in this survey that Wall Street Journal put out that has been tracking responses for many years that people seem to value more than they did in 1998 is money. Money is the only thing that is enhancing its social capital today. Deeply concerning for a lot of people.
And this brings us to the current season of The Mandalorian, Season 3. This is a show, The Mandalorian title. It was originally thought to refer to this character named Din Djarin, who is this sort of lone gunman bounty hunter. He takes Baby Yoda, or Grogu as we come to know him, into his care as a foundling. But the show really expanded its universe in the subsequent seasons to look at the story of the Mandalorians as a people who have lost their way. What resonated with you in terms of this Wall Street Journal survey, finding that Americans are much less engaged in their communities and prioritizing money more than they used to, and where The Mandalorian has been going?
Yeah, well, I think I was watching The Mandalorian and seeing this plot unfold where you have a Mandalorian bounty hunter who is part of a religious subset of the Mandalorian culture, known as the Children of the Watch. The Children of the Watch are these very traditionalist Mandalorians who have a specific doctrinaire version of what it means to be a Mando. The tenets of that faith basically require them to wear their helmets at all times, never show their face to another living human being, and fulfill a couple of other ways in which they're supposed to live their life. They are the ones who say, "This is the way." And when those Mandalorians say this is the way, they are saying that there are ways that are not the way that you should be living and that a Mandalorian should act. The Mandalorian, Din Djarin, is a bounty hunter. He is disconnected from his community by and large. He is living paycheck to paycheck, just chasing people down for money. And then we see him reconnect with the Children of the Watch over the course of the series. And it brings him closer and closer to his actual journey of becoming a hero. And then one of his colleagues, Bo-Katan, who is another Mandalorian who is not part of the Children of the Watch, she calls their group a cult. Very strong language. She does not like the Children of the Watch. She says they're a cult, and she does not keep her helmet on at all times. But then lo and behold, in the most recent season of The Mandalorian, after Bo-Katan's friends have all left her, she has failed in her quest to become the ruler of Mandalore, at least temporarily. She has nobody in her life. We see her depressed, lonely, and unsure what to do with her life. And what happens? She joins the Children of the Watch. She walks the way and starts wearing her helmet. And it actually makes her better off in the end. It was kind of hard for me not to see that, looking at this coming out at the same time as this Wall Street Journal poll, that we actually need people, structures, some semblance of value systems. Like, I would say pick any value system, but like have a value system that is coherent. Living as a loner, that's no way to live.
You know, and the two main value systems we've seen explored in depth in the movies and television series are this Mandalorian culture more recently, but it was originally the Jedi. And when we're introduced to it, there are a number of disparaging references to the Force as a religion, right? Han Solo, mm-hmm. "Hokey religions and ancient weapons," I think was his line. And then mm-hmm. in that same conference room scene we saw from, this is back in 1977, your sad adherence to that ancient religion when one of the bureaucrats is challenging Darth Vader. Do you see parallels today?
Yeah, I suppose so. Religiosity has really taken a nosedive, and it only is picking up with Generation Z identifying as unaffiliated with any kind of organized faith tradition. In that Wall Street Journal NORC survey, religious identification since 1998 has dropped now from 60% closer to 40%. And look, think about people in your life who are sort of unmoored from church communities, unconnected to different clubs or civic institutions. You know, they don't have people that they can call when a loved one gets cancer, comes down sick. They don't have somebody who they can ring when their kid needs to get picked up from school. That's what like churches, clubs, civic organizations do. That's what happens when you know your neighbors. You have people who you can rely on. I'm using all of these different outlets for connection. Honestly, like next week, I'm going on a vacation. I've got somebody to watch my dog. I've got somebody to watch the house. And I've got somebody to take care of my affairs while I'm away. And I only have those connections because I am involved both in church, in a community club, in my HOA, and on my block. I would have nothing because my family doesn't live here. It's just me and my wife and my daughter here. Who would take care of us if anything ever went wrong? This is kind of what happens in The Mandalorian for several characters. All right, sure, maybe the Children of the Watch is a cult. They have, sort of a very rigid structure about what it means to be a Mandalorian. They have all these rules and guidelines. But here's the thing, they're also incredibly open, tolerant, and are willing to bring anybody into the Mandalorian way that they live if they so choose. You just have to follow the rules. I'm not against rules, especially if you want to be part of a community or way of life.
We only have a few minutes left in our conversation. I do want to touch on one more of the themes from your book, How the Force Can Fix the World, and that is empathy. Empathy, I think you come from a background more on the right or the libertarian. You mentioned you were a goth conservative kid in high school. I think empathy is something that, at least on the surface, is much more associated with the left in America. Can you talk about how you think of empathy in America today through Star Wars?
Yeah. So my chapter in How the Force Can Fix the World on empathy, I was actually writing at the time January 6 was going down. I was in the coffee shop watching all of this unfold on television and working on this chapter about Star Wars and masks. We have numerous characters throughout Star Wars, particularly the villains who are concealed by masks, Darth Vader, Kylo Ren, even some of our heroes, Rey and Finn in the new sequel trilogy are introduced to us in masks. Stormtroopers were always masked characters. We had never seen one of their faces, which made them like really good cannon fodder for getting killed in gunfight after gunfight, because they're hardly even human to people watching these movies. They're just stormtroopers. And Star Wars continually undermines this way of thinking. We have to learn and see characters accept Darth Vader is not more machine than man. He is a human being, and Luke believes in it despite everyone telling him to give up. We see this happen with Kylo Ren as well in the sequel trilogy. Rey calls him a creature and a mask, mm-hmm. only for him to then remove his helmet and shock the living daylights of her by being a cute boy, honestly, like played by Adam Driver. Then yeah. she doesn't know what to do. She's like, I thought you were this automaton monster. And then she invests in saving him because she knows that he was a human being. He's the son of Han and Leia, for Pete's sake. This is really, really powerful for all of us in our own lives who get tempted to treat people like avatars or cartoons of themselves, to treat a human being on Twitter or Facebook anything less than human because they're using a screen name and have an avatar and are concealing their identity. It's remarkable how that sort of leads us to then treat them any less than we would treat them in person, like there's a person on the other side of that conversation.
That is a great point, I think, on which to end our saga. Stephen Kent, thank you so much for being with us today on The 21st Show.
Brian, it was a pleasure. This is the way.
This is the way. Stephen Kent is the author of How the Force Can Fix the World, Lessons on Life, Liberty, and Happiness from a Galaxy Far, Far Away. You can also find his newsletter on Substack at thisistheway.substack.com. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.